This was done through law, in part. Laws were passed declaring the complete equal rights for women during the Civil War. And laws were also passed to try to improve conditions for women. A divorce, which had been very restricted under the old regime due to the rules of the church, was now as easy as could possibly be. In fact, all you had to do to get divorced, according to the new law passed during the Civil War, was write a postcard to your spouse informing them they were no longer married, and that was enough. Abortion, until then completely illegal, banned by the church, became free and completely legal. Indeed, a special branch of the Communist Party was set up called the Jeunesse, the Women's Department, was formed to encourage women to act more independently, to act like equals. They also tried to educate men. For example, there was a big national campaign in the midst of the Civil War against wife beating, a very common occurrence, especially among workers and peasants in Russia. Communists would even gather in villages or in factories and engage in public rituals known as belt buryings, when men were told to bring you the belts you whip your wife with and we will bury it ceremoniously. This too was part of the Civil War. Some communists, in fact, even sought to take the first steps to abolishing what they described as the oppression of the family, seen as an institution mainly for economic exploitation, not a bond of love. They encouraged in its place what many communists called free love, that intimacy should be a private matter between individuals, not an institutionalized one under law. And to facilitate that, they set up collective childcare arrangements, collective kitchens, and the like. Parallel to these efforts to transform gender relations, to emancipate women, were campaigns to transform everyday life, especially among the lower classes, to emancipate the people from their backwardness, it was said. There were, for example, campaigns against religious beliefs, what were called demystification campaigns, where saints would be dug up from the ground to show peasants how they had rotted, or cases in which a communist would stand in the streets of a village and say, "I will show you how I can blaspheme God, who doesn't exist because he won't do anything," calls God all sorts of names. It said, "Now if God exists, he will strike me dead with lightning," which of course didn't happen. Also, churches were closed and priests were arrested as well. It was also a massive literacy campaign to emancipate people from their lack of knowledge through their lack of ability to read. There were campaigns against swearing and drinking and fighting, even campaigns to transform trivial customs. For example, communists would go to villages and suggest to peasants that it wasn't good to eat only with a spoon, that a fork and a knife were signs of civilization, all part of transforming the society. And side by side with these practical efforts to create a new world, again, part of what the Civil War also was about, there was also a side of radical imagination of even more sudden changes, more dramatic utopian transformations of the world. And this was seen especially among artists, in poetry, in fiction, in art. In fact, many of the most radical avant-garde left-wing, as they were often called, left-wing artists before the revolution joined the communist cause because they believed they were creating this dramatic new liberated world. And to illustrate these sorts of visions, I want to describe two proposed public monuments, both characteristically filled with wild visions of unlimited possibility and transformation, both proposed for the new capital and the old capital, Moscow, and both characteristically never built. First was a contribution suggested in September 1918 to Lenin's plans to decorate Soviet cities with big, instructive, monumental sculptures that would express for people the meanings of the revolution. This proposal appeared in a government-published magazine. It was proposed by an artist whose name was Ivan Shadr, who came from a working-class background, but though learned to become a sculptor and now was going to be a grand architect. And he created this huge architectural and sculptural ensemble that was to be called the Monument to the World's Suffering, the suffering, of course, that the revolution would end.